The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Well, earlier this week, Ryanair's Michael O'Leary decided to disembark from horse racing after two decades in the race. My next guest has trained a number of horses owned by the Ryanair boss and is one of Ireland's most successful trainers. Noel Mead joins me now. Noel, were you surprised when Michael announced that he was getting out of the racing game?
Ah, yes, I'm sure everybody was surprised. I don't think I was totally shocked either now, because Michael has been, he's thrown his heart and soul into it for a good many years, and he's been very successful. And I know he's a young family coming up, and he hasn't spent as much time racing this year as usual. So basically he hasn't said he's getting out of racing. What he said was he had stopped buying horses, stopped replacing them. He has a lot of very nice horses to run, so he has a few years in him yet.
You have trained for him. You would have trained, what, a few dozen horses, would you, in the last season?
Yeah, over the last couple of years now, we've had somewhere between 20 and 30 horses a season.
So what's he like to deal with then?
Oh, Michael is a perfect gentleman. He takes the barometer, basically, when you're talking about owners, is basically how they take losing, and Michael is a good loser. He's a good winner and he's a good loser. He's a great man to train for.
He has the whole reputation of being a tough taskmaster. Did you see that in action? Is he hard on trainers, hard on jockeys?
Yeah, Michael, I remember saying to Michael one night, we were out having dinner one night, and I said to Michael, you know, Michael, maybe the jockeys might know more about riding horses than you do. I said, you never were a jockey. And Michael said, well, he said, I never flew a plane either. You can talk it through with Michael, there's no problem. He's like, everything is, he can talk it through. He has his own opinion, which is good, and he tells you what he thinks. And the one thing about Michael is you know where you stand with him all along. He likes his horses ridden forward in races. He likes his jockeys to be handy, and he makes that known, and if they don't, he's happy to change them or to tell them not. But that's the way he likes them done, and there's no big problem about that.
Now, the scale of his operation has been huge. I think he would have had 225 horses in total racing last season. His winnings over the years have come to about €28 million. But the costs on the other side would be well up there. It's an expensive operation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an expensive operation, there's no question. Although I think he probably has run it a lot better than most people that have been in that. It's been a very successful operation. And the winnings over the last couple of years have been very high because they've bought so well, and once they feel they're not up to the standard they require, they move them on, they sell them on. And it's been a very well-run operation.
What about after Michael O'Leary? Obviously, we had a thriving industry before he came along. We may well, I'm sure, have a thriving industry afterwards in the future as well. But how do you see all that playing out? Are there enough newcomers coming in who are looking to buy horses? And is there anybody who would be able to do it on the sort of scale that he did?
I don't see anyone at the moment around that's going to buy at the same scale as he's bought. But like, JP has been buying horses as many horses as Michael has for years, and he's on a similar scale or maybe even bigger. Like Willie Mullins has quite a few owners that are very big in the game. I don't think that Michael moving away is going to be the end of the world for everybody. Like, I mean, it's certainly going to affect some of the producers in the fact that he was a great buyer and he spent a lot of money. It's going to be a little bit of a setback for a year or so, but I'm sure it'll cover over.
And with Gigginstown, people talk about Michael O'Leary, but his brother Eddie, of course, would have done a lot of the buying, and he's also still involved and will be involved because he would have bought for himself too, wouldn't he?
Eddie has a very bought all the horses for Michael, and Eddie is probably as fine a judge of a horse as there is in this country, and as he's proved.
Do you mean just when he goes into a sales yard, he knows what he's looking for, or he's able to spot something in a horse?
Yeah, he can look at a horse and sum him up in a matter of seconds. He actually can look at a horse in 5-10 seconds and make up his mind whether he likes him or he doesn't. And when Eddie sees a horse he likes, I've been with him many times, and when he sees a horse he likes, he can see it in him straight away. But he's a supreme judge of a horse, and if anything, he probably has been too successful for Michael, because they've won, you know, they've won 2 Gold Cups and 3 Grand Nationals and many, many other races as well. So most of that was brought down to the buying power or the buying knowledge of Eddie.
For those of us who aren't involved in the industry, Noel, what are you looking for when you go in and within 10 seconds you're able to see something in an animal that you think, yes, that's going to be a winner? What are the signs?
Well, first and foremost, he must be an athlete. He must be able to use every bit of his body. Like, I mean, if you walk around the studio here and you look at different people, and you'd say, well, there's no Mead anyway, and he's not an athlete. He's not going to walk. He's not going to run too far. But the horse is the same. You see the one that can and the one that can't. He can use his shoulders. He can use his back end when he's walking around. When you see a horse move around and see the way he can shunt along and move his shoulders, move his hind end, move every piece of his body. He has to be an athlete. And then he has to have things in the right place. And when I say this, if his confirmation must be correct, if his confirmation is not correct, he'll wear quicker. If he's putting
his confirmation.
If he puts his foot down crooked. If his knees are not straight down, and or his ankle joints are not straight. If he's turning a foot out or he's turning it in, when he comes down on the ground, it'll come down and there'll be more pressure on that joint, more pressure on his knee, more pressure on his fetlock or where his ankle joint. And after a while, that'll start to wear, and then his action will shorten, and he won't use himself as well.
And you could see all that just from the way the horse walks. You don't even have to see it run.
Yes, you can see it. Now, look, you can get that horse that looks like absolute perfection, and then he may not be able to run out of his own way, because that happens. That has happened as well. And then, of course, pedigree comes into it after that. Like, I mean, what the most important end of the pedigree is the mare, and then you go to the sire. And, of course, again, the sire probably hasn't as much input into it as the mare.
What about training then, which is also where you come in? From my own interests growing up, our family, we were big into athletics rather than horses.
Yeah.
But a lot of the athletics running techniques that were around even in the 1970s and 80s, such as interval training, where, you know, you ran a series of 400 metres with a short gap in between and put yourself through hell. Does that sort of stuff work on horses?
Absolutely. I started training from nowhere. I was bred, born and reared a farmer, and just had a serious love for horses. And I just happened to be lucky now. Things worked out for me, and from the very beginning it seemed to just go forward and forward. But certainly one of the things that stands out most in my mind is a guy that I met. He was a coach in the English athletic squad, and I bumped into him about, I'd say in the 80s, and I spent a bit of time and got a lot of knowledge from him about the way athletes were trained and about interval training, and we moved that direction quite a bit. And certainly even to this day we would use a lot of what he said. We had to temper it in different directions, because with humans you can say, look, you're going to run in the national championships on the 14th of June, whatever, but you can't tell a horse that. So you're going to train for a year for that, but you can't tell a horse you're going to run in Cheltenham or you're going to run in Ascot or whatever. So you have to get into his mind in a different direction, and you can't blow it. You have to just let him bring him along.
And you can't ask him how he's feeling either.
You can't ask him, but you can't ask him how he's feeling. But this is where you have to be careful, because you have to feel that feeling. You have to look at him and there's a great saying with some people, and Eddie O'Leary actually is one of the ones that says it. He says, you know, he says he looks like he needs a hug, you know, when you get a horse and he gets down and he's a little bit down of himself. But this is where you have to be very careful in not doing too much and keeping them up, and where you have to get them to a stage where you get them fit and still well and still bouncing, you know.
Does a horse get a sense of the occasion?
Yeah, I've very little doubt that a lot of them do. And certainly they do know when they win. And like one horse in particular, like he's become a national treasure at the moment, is Tiger Roll. And there's no question or doubt about it that Tiger Roll knows who he is and what he is, because he's just... He's grown in stature. Like, he's not a big horse, but he thinks he's a big horse. And he's bouncing around in all these. He's been paraded here, there, and everywhere. And every day you see him, he seems to have got 2 or 3 inches bigger because he's so full of himself at this stage. But there's no doubt he knows that he's a superstar now.
When it comes to understanding the horses, you're very much relying on the jockeys that you have to feed back how they think the horse is behaving, or how they think the horse is, or whether they think the horse is in good form or not in good form.
Yeah, obviously, and that goes from even the exercise riders right down every day. Some of them you take more heed of than others, because some of them would always have something wrong, or some of them would always, you know. But I would take heed of them all, to be honest with you. I'd listen to them, and you sort of decipher it as you get used to get to know them. Paul Carberry had his own ideas about some of the explanations he gave about racing and way horses ran. I remember one day we were in Kilbeggan, and this horse ran very slow. He was obviously no good, and we were sort of at our way at the end of the line. And Paul arrives back in anyway, and he loosens the girths and pulls the saddle off and turns around to me and for the debrief. And the owner's standing beside me, and I'm standing there looking at him anyway. And I said, "Well, have you anything to say?" And he said, "Well," he said, "he made a noise." And I said, "What sort of a noise?" "Oh," he said, "it sounded like, wait for me." No, I've been lucky now to have had some very good riders. Richard Dunwoody rode a good few winners for me as well. And he was a very good rider as well.
How did you become a trainer in the first place, Noel?
Well, as I said to you earlier there, I was bred, born and reared a farmer. So, and funny enough, none of us in the family, or nobody in the family, had anything to do with racing. But I was racing mad from the time I was a kid. And I was brought up watching Arkle on TV. And Tom Draper was my idol at that time. He was the trainer. Now, obviously, when you're a kid and whatever, all you want to be is a jockey. So, but I wasn't very good at that, to be honest. And I started off with a pal of mine, and we bought a few horses. The first one or two weren't much good. And then we came across a horse called Tuva, which we bought for 100 quid. And he won a couple of races. He wasn't much good either, now, to be honest. But I was riding him, and he was like a little cash machine, because every day we ran him, he got money. He was second or third when he won three. I think he won three or four as well. And I managed to win on him as well, so he must have been very good. but then people asked me to train a horse or two, and I ended up training three or four the first year I had a license, which was back in 1971, I think, and it sort of built on from there.
So you were relying really on your own instincts about it. You weren't necessarily trained to be a trainer.
Oh no, I never trained with any other trainer. And probably something I always regretted, because you know, I'm constantly questioning trainers. I remember Martin Pipe coming over to me one time to look at a horse, and I had him in the sitting room, and I was questioning him this, that, and the other, and I apologised to him in the end, and I said to him, "I'm sorry, Martin, I'm sure interrogating you so much." And he said, "Oh, it's quite all right." He says, "I've known what you're at." He says, but Martin is a lovely man. He didn't mind, because he loved talking about it himself.
Are there a lot of trade secrets that you just don't share with each other as trainers? Do you get on well? Do you socialise together? Is there a lot of rivalry?
There's plenty of rivalry now. There is plenty of rivalry, but we do get on well. I think Irish trainers get on better with each other than English trainers. But then again, it's a bit like there are trainers you get on better with than you do with others, you know. And I'm sure there are people we don't get on with, but I don't, to be honest with you, have very few that I don't get on with. I think I get on. I like people. I like talking to people, and I like to be nice to people. I think that. I think I get on well with most people, but then I would have people that I would be trainers that I would socialise with more than I would with others, you know.
If somebody wants to own a horse, buy a horse, a share in a horse, a leg of a horse, whatever it is it really possible to go out and buy a winner, and what might it cost you?
You can spend anything from 1,000 to 1 million. On a horse, or an actual fact, you can spend 5 million if you wish, but obviously that's a different thing. But the general run of it, store horses at the moment, 3-year-olds that are unbroken and ready to start off, you're probably talking in terms of between 30 to 70 or 80 to sort of buy into that. You know, it's hard. It can.
And every week and every month they've got to be fed, and they've got to be trained, and they've got to be taken care of.
That's right. Look, it's not something that anybody can get into and just forget about the thing that, look, I'm going to buy this and make my fortune, because it doesn't work like that. I have to say that it has to be thought about as an expendable income to be used, because I think you could put yourself on the road if you were sort of thought, I'm going to buy a horse and make my fortune, you know.
And what about you, Noel? Any plans to retire? Are you going to keep going? Are you still enjoying it as much as ever?
I'm certainly going to keep going as long as I can anyway, because I love what I do. I love going racing. I love the people I meet. I like the people in the industry. I like the banter as well. And I also love going out in the morning. I think there's nothing nicer than going out and seeing the horses, especially in a good morning. It's maybe not that nice in a wet morning. We have plenty of problems with WRC and staff shortages and everything like that. But look, that's life. I don't actually agree with retirement anyway. I think when you stop working, you stop living.
Well, Noel Mead, trainer, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
You're welcome.